Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up. As Afghanistan verges on a humanitarian catastrophe, Zameh Khalilzad, the former U.S. envoy who struck America's deal with the Taliban, joins me. Then, don't let me down. Don't let me down. Get Back director Peter Jackson shows us the Beatles as we've never seen them before. And
the world is not going to change itself. That is up to you, like literally you.
Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine talks to Hari Srinivasan about social justice and making music through voice memos. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Afghanistan is bracing for winter amid a crisis of hunger and deep, deep poverty. 3 months since the chaotic withdrawal by U.S. and allied forces, a U.N. envoy is warning that ISIS has now entered almost every one of the country's provinces, and the Taliban continues its relentless crackdown on women. So how did it get this way, and was there any alternative to the U.S. withdrawal? Joining me now is Zameh Khalilzad. He advised President George W. Bush when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan after 9/11, and he also negotiated the U.S. withdrawal some 20 years later with the Taliban under President Donald Trump. Zameh Khalilzad, welcome from Washington, D.C. Let me start by just putting what we've just said to you, because you've got the withdrawal, you have the abandonment of many Afghans who supported the American war effort, you have the crackdown on women, and you have this looming famine. Was there any, well, did you expect it to get this bad in the intervening, you know, couple of months since the withdrawal?
Well, the situation is not good. The situation was not good before either. There was a war going on that had gone on for a very long time. People were tired of war. Now the situation is one of what to do on humanitarian front, as well as what to do to address the human rights concerns. And the United States and the international community needs to do its part using diplomacy, using what the Talibs want as leverage to address these issues. But war was not the solution either. It had gone on for too long.
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. But right now, it is much, much worse in a humanitarian way than it was before the withdrawal. The Afghan economy is expected to contract by 30% this year. More than 95% of the population could fall into poverty and famine, many of them in the coming months. That's according to the UN. So should the United States lift the financial sanctions? Should it recognize the Taliban government in order to help the people with you know, financial aid and food and the like? Should the, you know, the World Bank, the IMF, resume lending to the country?
I think the people of Afghanistan should not suffer as a result of disagreements that exist between the international community, including the United States and the Taliban. What I've been advocating is to provide substantial humanitarian assistance, and to do it as soon as possible. But in addition, the Taliban have a list of demands from the international community. They want to be lifted, the sanctions to be lifted on them, including travel and the list that they are on. They want normal relations with the international community, and they want to get assistance and recognition. And the international community has its own list of concerns, including humanitarian access, including people having the right to travel, respect for the rights of all Afghans, including women, and on terrorism front. So the two need to continue to negotiate, that is the international community, the United States, and the Talibs, to fulfill the parts of the Doha Agreement that have not been fulfilled, what we, in other words, would be willing to do in exchange for what the Talibs do. It has to be negotiated, and it has to be in writing. It has to be step for a step by each side.
Yeah. Okay, I guess you're saying all that because clearly there were a lot of holes in the deal that was negotiated with you in the lead position. So I just want to ask you personally, you know, as you know, I watched you battle diplomatically from the very beginning after 9/11 to get rid of the Taliban, to bring a modicum of democracy and freedom and human rights to that country, to get rid of Talibanism. And then 20 years later, you know, you go as, you know, Trump's Terminator to so-called negotiations in Doha, which brings them back full circle into power. You know, given your career, given everything you've done as an Afghan American, how do you feel about that?
Well, the question is, realistically, what were the alternatives? And the alternative was the continuation of a war that we were losing. I mean, every year for the previous 7 years, the Talibs were winning. And there was no support for continuing that war effort in the United States. And second, there was no desire to escalate. So the decision was made, it's better to negotiate. I wish the situation had been different, but we can't wish things. We have to deal with realities that we had. And the president of the United States, a Democrat and a Republican, actually three presidents, starting with Obama, wanted to end the war. The world had changed. China had become a bigger problem to focus on. Terrorism was not the same as it was before. And the Afghan situation was not moving in the right direction. Given those circumstances, the agreement was the best option possible that could be arrived at. That the Afghan government and the Talibs didn't take advantage of the opportunity provided by the United States, that is, to start inter-Afghan negotiations that had not taken place for the previous decades. That is a historic mistake that they made. But the business of Afghanistan and our concerns are not over. Now, using diplomacy, assistance, release of funds, political normalization, those are the leverages that are appropriate for the current circumstances. I wish things had been different, but they weren't. And we had to deal with the situation.
Okay, so let me tell. Okay. But you knew everything about Afghanistan. You were probably one of the most knowledgeable of the country. And, you know, of course, nothing was perfect. And many of those things you say are true, that the country was fed up with war. And the three presidents you mentioned wanted to withdraw. However, there are still many people who criticize your negotiating tactics and suggest that you gave away too much to the Taliban without them fulfilling any of the conditions or promises. Even a Trump administration official, Lisa Curtis, who worked with you, you know, on this issue, I believe Ambassador Khalilzad was too willing to make concessions to the Taliban and to throw the Afghan government under the bus. One of your former allies in Afghanistan, a former vice president, said you were the architect of a great deception. So react to that. And also, I want to ask you myself, did you really think that the Taliban was interested in anything else than a military victory, which they actually achieved?
Well, I mean, there are people in the United States who are supportive of continuing war in Afghanistan, and I respect that. But they were not the people in decision-making. President Trump and President Biden are elected leaders of the United States. They are the one who decided. And they are the one who decided on the terms of the agreement. I think commentary is one thing, but the reality was that given the circumstances and the trends, the agreement was the best that could be achieved, and it gave the United States what it wanted, a safe withdrawal of its troops. Not a single American was killed by the Talibs since the agreement was signed. The Talibs agreed that we could come to the defense of the Afghan forces if they attacked them after the agreement. The Talibs agreed with both sides that they will sit together and negotiate. That was introduced agreed to in the agreement, the fact that the government wanted the war to continue, and some in the United States, for reasons of their own, wanted the war to go on. Ending a war is not easy. There is a lot of interest involved in continuing the war. That is their point of view. But the United States government, the presidents, several presidents decided this war was not going well. It was better for the U.S. to cut its losses, focus on the problems of the current period, and give the Afghans the chance to negotiate with each other. And there was a lot of pessimism whether the Afghans would agree to, with each other on a political settlement. And the pessimists turned out to be right.
Many of the military forces that the United States backed are very upset, and they believe they're being slandered by all the Americans who say they refused to fight, which we know they did fight, and they lost tens of thousands of their own people over the years in a joint effort. Many say it was when the United States made it clear that they would no longer support them, that they had nowhere to turn. And you know Afghanistan, and you know how people roll over allegiances depending on, you know, where they think and who they think is going to be in power. But you also, and you admit it yourself, asked the government, you suggested to your old friend Ashraf Ghani, the president, that he resign as the Taliban demanded at Doha. Tell me why you thought that was a good idea at the time as part of the negotiations.
Sure. First, I do agree that individual Afghan soldiers did fight bravely, but when push came to shove, and they, to our surprise, to everyone's surprise, the armed forces collapsed. There are lessons to be learned from that, that they collapsed because they were too dependent on the United States psychologically and operationally. That raises questions about how we help build security forces for other countries. Although the fact is that in the agreement, we retained the right to come to their to the defense of the Afghan forces when they were attacked. And we did that. That was an extraordinary concession from the Talibs that they wouldn't attack us, but we could attack them. Regarding a political settlement, I have to say that given the balance of power when the negotiating teams from the two sides were not making progress, the United States did propose a possible compromise that the government will be made up of elements from both sides, perhaps as 50-50%, and that the head of the government would be someone acceptable to both sides. Now, wouldn't that have been better given what happened? It was a terrible miscalculation on the part of President Ghani and his team that they thought that was unacceptable, and look what happened given realities on the ground. Wouldn't Afghanistan been better off with a mutually accepted head of state with power sharing and a legitimate government not subject to the kind of steps that the current government is subjected to?
Did you feel your hands were tied, given that President Trump made it very clear that there was no more leverage because they had a set date to withdraw?
Well, I had to deal with the situation that I had, not the situation I wished I had. And the president, I negotiated the condition-based agreement, and the four conditions were U.S. withdrawal, but in exchange for Talib commitment and the Afghan government commitment on terrorism, negotiations among Afghans, and a comprehensive ceasefire. Ultimately, President Trump and President Biden both decided follow a calendar-based withdrawal, not a condition-based withdrawal. Those were decisions way above my pay grade. But I think given those realities, the war not going well, the desire to adapt to the new international environment and do terror environment, Afghanistan's leaders not willing to negotiate with each other, all caused the president of the United States to say we should just get out based on a calendar, on a timetable.
Okay, and the result is a disaster. I mean, let's just not beat around the bush. The result is a disaster when more than half the country are about to be, you know, have famine conditions and poverty. They need help. They're not getting it. Women are being completely, abused and their rights taken away by the Taliban. This is what Fawzia Kofi, who I know you know very well, she was the Afghan government representative at the talks. This is what she told me more than a month after the collapse of Kabul and the withdrawal of U.S. forces about the women.
The expectation of people in Afghanistan, especially the women of Afghanistan, is that the world continue to use their leverage for the rights of women. Because after 20 years, Christian, for us to talk about the rights to education is heartbreaking. Honestly, as a woman, it's heartbreaking for us to see that we are still struggling for our right to go to school.
Wow. So, Zameh Khalilzad, it is heartbreaking because of the great successes that came after the U.S. invasion in 2001. Women's rights and children's rights were a huge success. So I guess I want to ask you,
it was a great success for part of Afghanistan society, and those who were benefiting from the U.S. presence now are some of them are upset because the U.S. Has withdrawn. But I believe the women's rights issue is an important issue. It should be a central factor in affecting U.S. and international policy towards Afghanistan. But we shouldn't be driven by revenge or by the desire of part of the Afghan society who are nostalgic about the days that they were dominant, but they couldn't really conduct a policy that was successful. And they couldn't also be realistic enough to make a peace agreement. The time has come for Afghans to accept each other. They are different in terms of their values. They have to come to an agreement on a formula for Afghanistan to work and for the international community to assist in that regard. But the continuing the war in which thousands of Afghans lost their lives.
Yes. You've said this before.
And the American decision that was not sustainable. Those were also not the realities that could be sustained.
Yeah. Zalmay Khalilzad, I hear the sound of water as you, on behalf of the American government, wash your hands of everything there, including the women. So I'm going to ask you a last question. Do you share the outrage
of the American military service members? The mission of the U.S. military is not a humanitarian mission,
Mr. Khalilzad,
except in exceptional circumstances. Right. The mission of the U.S. military was to go after the Taliban because of 9/11. And the Taliban paid a high price for that mistake they made. They say they will not make that mistake again. But as far as the future of Afghanistan is concerned,
the U.S. is making the mistake again. I just need to ask you one more question. One more question. What about the American servicemen who are absolutely crushed that the people they gave a sacred promise to, who helped the war effort, have been abandoned? Do you share that sense of betrayal?
No. No, not at all. These people fought for themselves, not for the United States. Afghans fought for Afghanistan. The self-flagellation that some suffer from is unwarranted. Afghans fought for themselves, not for the United States. The U.S. fought for itself and helped Afghanistan. But it didn't work. It worked in some ways. The Talibs were punished. Hopefully they will be deterred doing what they did the last time. And Afghanistan was transformed, but the time has come for Afghans to come together, agree on a political roadmap for themselves, and the international community should assist.
All right. Well, let's see if that all comes true. Zalmay Khalilzad, thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be with you, Christian.
And next, we go back 50 years to an unseen treasure trove of music and film of the Beatles. You think you know all there is to know about the Fab Four? Think again. None other than the Oscar-winning director Peter Jackson has worked his Lord of the Rings magic on this ancient archive to give us a whole new view of some of the last Beatle recording sessions and a whole new take on whether the famous rooftop concert was in fact a breakup offering to their fans. Here's a clip from Jackson's film, Get Back.
We're talking about 14 songs we hope to get.
I've got a feeling
How many have we already recorded? Good enough?
No.
None of us has had the idea of what the show's gonna be.
I've got feeling.
I would dig to play on stage, you know. Nobody else wants to do a show.
I think we've got a bit shy.
So all of this drops as a three-part series on Disney Plus later this week over the Thanksgiving break. And I've been speaking to Peter Jackson about the amazing new light that he's shedding on John, Paul, George and Ringo. Peter Jackson, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So what is your earliest memory of the Beatles? I mean, were you a fan from you know, being a child or what?
Well, I was born in 1961, so theoretically I was alive when all their albums were coming out, but I had a mother and father who were not Beatle orientated. I mean, they at home we had the soundtrack album of South Pacific and those sorts of things. Not a single Beatles record. So I have no memory particularly of the Beatles during the 60s, apart from the fact that I must have liked them. I must have heard them on the radio, must have seen them on TV, because as soon as I could save up enough pocket money, which took me until I was about 12. When I was about 12, I went into the city, went to the record store, and I bought my very first Beatle album. And they'd already broken up at this stage. We're talking about 1972 or 73. But I spent my first ever pocket money buying my first ever Beatles album. So I must have liked them.
I guess this was then meant to be. I mean, Peter Jackson was meant to put this incredible series together. Are you surprised that one of the most mega groups of all humankind of all time actually had, you know, 50 plus hours of unseen film footage that's been, or more, that hasn't been seen for so many decades?
The best bit of us always has been and always will be is when we're backs against the wall.
All we've got is us. What do you think?
It completely blows my mind. And I'm not describing the film that I've made and anything else, just the fact that this stuff after 50 years, you know, over 50 years, all the documentaries, everything, you've got to think you've seen everything there is to do with the Beatles, you know. Since the documentaries you see tend to recycle the same footage, Ed Sullivan, press conferences, so that, you just sort of think, okay, well, we've sort of seen it all and now we're just, you know, looking at interviews and various things. But suddenly out of nowhere, seemingly out of nowhere, and it's not just that there's, you know, 60 hours of new Beatles footage. It's the best Beatles footage that has ever been seen. Michael Lindsay Hogg shot it in 1969, and it was used for his movie Let It Be, which was about 80 minutes long. So we're talking about the outtakes from Let It Be, which is essentially 60 hours, that the Beatles, because of the whole stigma of the breakup when Let It Be was released, they actually, I mean, it's the Beatles themselves that have ordered this to be locked in the vault and never be seen. It's not just that it was lost and forgotten about. They have never wanted anyone to see it.
Okay, so that's it. That's incredible. I actually didn't know that nugget, so that's really interesting.
Yeah.
So I guess the next question is, well, clearly you obviously got the key to the vault, but did you negotiate or talk with the two remaining Beatles, the two living Beatles? Were they part of the creative process at all for you?
I didn't talk to them when sort of the actual thing was being hatched. That was done with the chiefs of the company, Geoff Jones and Jonathan Clyde, who worked for AppleCorp, it's a Beatles company. So, discussing the idea of the film and me jumping on board was all done there. I got the idea that they weren't going to give me access to Paul and Ringo until it was all kind of, until it was underway. And then certainly once it was happening and I was on board, everything had been sorted out, then Paul and Ringo have been available to me ever since. Incredibly supportive. And has Sean Lennon and Olivia Harrison and Danielle Harrison, the entire group have been incredibly supportive, and in a way not just supportive. They've given me the greatest gift that I could ever have, and is that they've left me alone. they've always been there if I want to ask them something, but they've always let me make the film that I want to make, which I really very very grateful for.
Well, really interestingly, Paul McCartney has been interviewed, obviously, about this, and on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, he said that what you provided was this incredible sort of like, almost like a family scrapbook. His memories had dulled over the years and maybe been overtaken by the chat that the world was having about what this original film was. Let me just play what Paul McCartney said.
Overall, I think it proves that there was a great loving spirit in the Beatles that entered into the music and everything we did. And that, for me, was more than a relief to see it. It was great. It was very emotional and very lovely to be able to see John and George again and just remember how sweet it was to work with them and to make this music.
I think that's really nice because certainly from what we hear, Peter Jackson, is that the original film, Let It Be, was almost considered to be a breakup film. Did you find that when you looked at all the outtakes?
Well, just to talk about Let It Be for a second, because, I mean, Michael Lindsay-Hogg shot all this footage, the footage that my film's being made from, and he shot it in 1969, and he made his film Let It Be. And his movie is absolutely, it's not a breakup film. And his movie had the bad luck of being released after the Beatles had broken up. Because, of course, once he'd shot all the footage, I mean, he shot the 60 hours of footage that I have in January 69. That wasn't the movie finished. He had to go away for a year and do all the editing. I mean, it's taken us 4 years to edit, but Michael managed to cut his film in just over a year. And so he was working on that. And the Beatles, in the meantime, before his film came out, they broke up. So his movie, obviously, he shot the footage as this incredible fly on the wall look at the Beatles. Then you go, in January 69, you go to May 1970, Let It Be, his movie comes out. The Beatles have just broken up. The headlines are saying they've broken up. People go to this fly on the wall film. And, you know, people would assume that this movie was shot a month ago, 2 months ago. This must be the Beatles in the process of a breaking up. They impose the newspaper headlines on to Michael's film, which is actually very unfair for the movie. But nonetheless, that stigma has survived for 50 years. So much survived that it's actually become fact. It's become the absolute... But how can it be a breakup film when it was shot 15 months earlier? It just can't be. It's impossible.
Yeah, and you were saying, I wanted to know what was going on. Well, clearly what was going on was unbelievable songwriting and music making.
Yeah,
and in those 22 days, they created 14 songs that became... and have remained iconic Beatles songs. How surprised were you by the work ethic or the method of how they worked and how they produced together?
So you're quite right. In that time, they write and record the 14 songs on Let It Be. They also, the Abbey Road album, which is going to come out in about 6 months, you know, from this period, 17 songs on Abbey Road, 12 of those songs are done during this period as well. Probably about 10 or 12 songs that appear on their solo albums are actually done. You've got, you know, George Harrison released a solo album called All Things Must Pass, the song. We've got the Beatles performing All Things Must Pass. Give Me Some Truth is a very famous song that John had on a solo album. You know, it's on the Imagine album.
Just give me some truth.
You know, the Beatles are performing Give Me Some Truth. All these solo songs that I have always thought of them as being solo songs, we've actually got the group performing them. And in addition, during this period, they perform about 220 old rock and roll songs at the same time. So prolific, yeah, they are incredibly, you know, this is a very... And actually, in this 22 days, the last 12 days, they work every day. They don't have the weekend off. It's like 12 days... In a row. They're worth it. The actual worker ethic is extraordinary. Focused, professional, but also full of humour as well.
And really full of affection for each other.
Yeah, love,
and
yeah,
it
yeah,
was
yeah.
so interesting to see Yoko there as well. Mm. And this was in the early days of her relationship with John. Mm. And to see Linda, who at the time was Linda Eastman, taking the pictures there. What can you tell us about that dynamic, what you glean from, you know, the 60 hours of video? And of course, you know, Paul has said recently that he just wants to clear up once and for all with this film and with the with the book that he's writing, that he didn't break the Beatles up.
Look, you know, Yoko sits with John in the studio, which, as I was a Beatles fan, you know, younger, you'd see photographs of John and Yoko in the studio and you think, oh, that's a bit weird. But, you know, when you see the footage and... You just watch them work. She's very respectful. She never interferes. She never has an opinion. You know, she doesn't say, "Oh, I think that solo should be faster." She writes. She knits. She reads newspapers. She's only there because Yoko and John are completely in love. So what is wrong with that? She's not there to make trouble. They're in love and they want to stay. You know, John doesn't want to leave the house and leave her alone and be away from her for eight or 9 hours, and why should he? So it's sort of it's strangely normal. It's always felt weird when I've looked at photos, but when you see you sitting there and they're all working, it's sort of, you think, okay, right, that's fine. That's fine.
And I mean, it's extraordinary. I hadn't known that in the middle of it or the beginning of it, George Harrison just announced very matter-of-factly, I quit, and he left.
Yeah. I know he does. You see, the interesting thing, Christian, is that, you know, we talked about how much love and affection they have for each other. And in a way, where that comes through strongest is when things go wrong. So there are moments like George walks out and you see the effect that it has on John and Paul and Ringo. You know, first of all, they're northern sort of macho boys from the north of England, so it's all macho. You know, oh, we'll get Eric Clapton in. But that drains. That macho, they can't actually sustain that, and they sink into a depression, and, you know, because they are really devastated by George leaving, even though they're trying to kind of hide it. You can tell they are. And you know, and then the overall plan that they're trying to do derails. And so in a way, we see more of the Beatles' personality, more of their friendship, their deep friendship and their love, because they're all having to deal with these kind of crisis. I mean, if it all was plain sailing, you sort of wouldn't. I don't think you'd actually get much of a sense of who they were. But the fact that they're having to deal with endless problems sort of really shows you who they are. And ultimately, they get through because of a long-held friendship. I mean, when the Beatles, when these kids in Liverpool got together as a group, but George Harrison was 13 years old, John Lennon was 16. I mean, these guys are old childhood friends. As you know, by the time we see them, there is a deep brotherly trust and almost a psychic bond between them.
And then there was the magic of the actual performance, because let's not forget, this was meant to culminate in a performance.
Yes.
And they hadn't performed, if I'm not mistaken, for 3 years previously. Yep. Mm-hmm. And as it says in the film, they just decided to walk upstairs and go and do it on the roof, which clearly surprised everybody in the neighborhood. Talk me through how that impacted you when you saw that and all the different cameras that the original film had employed to catch every angle.
Well, the rooftop concert, which is they go up and perform nine times. They perform five songs nine times because they're not only doing a so-called concert on the roof, there it's a recording session. They have all the amps and the mics go down five stories to the recording studio in the basement. There's cables down the staircase, so they're actually there to record for an album. It's not sort of technically just a bit of fun on the roof. So they do a few songs multiple times to get them right. And anyway, I've seen bits of the rooftop concert. I mean, I'm sure that we all have in various documentaries over, you know, one or two songs. And the 16mm film has all been grainy and a bit dull. And to be honest, I've never really liked the rooftop concert. I'd prefer to watch Shea Stadium or Ed Sullivan if I want to, you know, watch the Beatles play. So I've never really been a huge fan. It's always felt a bit. And I've also projected all the breakup stuff the same as everybody else onto the footage. So, but when I looked at the rushes, and I thought, okay, I just want to look at the rooftop rushes, because I know that they did night. It's 45 minutes long, the full thing, and they had 10 cameras filming. So I just sat there and I looked at all these 10, and we had it so that all 10 were sort of going at the same time, and I could sort of watch it all run. I just thought this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen in my life. I mean, this is the most extraordinary footage shot of the Beatles in performance. And in a way, it has to be seen in its full length to appreciate that, because what you get, apart from, you know, the angles and the shots, you get the sense of these guys up on the roof. They haven't played together for, as you say, for 3 years. They want to go back, is the name of the film. They want to get back. They don't want to be Sergeant Pepper anymore. They don't want to be the Shea Stadium Mop Tops. They don't want to be the Ed Sullivan. They want to go back to Hamburg and the Cavern Club. They want to go back to their teenage years and just play rock and roll as four guys. And they haven't actually done that for a long time. And they're nervous. They don't know whether they can recapture that. And the first song, yeah, okay, a little bit rough. The second one gets better. And by the third song, they are cooking. So so you actually see it as a run. You really are emotionally on their side, and by the fourth song, they are having a blast. So in a weird way, they're playing, they're surprising themselves at how great they are, because they've actually forgotten how great they are. You sort of see it on their faces. They get so into it. God, they're tight. And such a great performance. So, you know, seeing the full thing has become my all-time favorite Beatles performance. And I hope other people will feel the same way.
It's amazing. Did they approach you because of this incredible film that you did about World War I, They Shall Not Grow Old, where you took, you know, original pictures and restored them and added color? And I mean, we know how great that film was. Is that what led them to you? As you also had to sort of restore or adjust, I think, somehow, some of the film, right? Because it was not up to scratch.
We certainly did that. And so They Shall Not Grow Old helped us ultimately with the restoration. No, this is the ultimate being in the right place at the right time story. I work in New Zealand, but at the time, this is 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, I was traveling to London to do They Shall Not Grow Old, go into the Imperial War Museum film vaults and look at all that. So I was making these sort of trips. And on one of these trips, Apple Corps must have heard that, obviously. I don't know how they did it. They must have read an interview with me, because I'd never met any of these guys before. Because I had been, at the time, I was interested in VR and AR and all this, sort of putting glasses on. And I still am, but so I must have talked about that in an interview that they'd seen, because I got this note while I was in London to ask if I wouldn't mind dropping by Apple Corps to have a chat with Jeff Jones, Jonathan Clyde, about VR and AR. And I go there, they tell me that they're thinking about a Beatles exhibition of some sort, live exhibition, and they are thinking about the technology. And could they have it? Not necessarily, can you do it, Peter? It's just like, can you, we hear you're interested. Can you explain to us how this works? And so we talked about that for a bit. And as a Beatles fan, over the years, I'd always had this thought in my head. Let it be. Michael Lindsay Hogg shot this footage. His movie's 80 minutes long. I know he shot a lot more than that. I don't know how much. I wonder if the film survives. I couldn't really get the answer from any books, but I've always wondered, is there other Let It Be outtakes that no one's ever seen? So when, at the right moment in the meeting, and trying not to sound like a fan, trying to just sound sort of like a professional person, I said to them, let It Be. There's obviously more footage. Did any of those outtakes survive? Because that might be interesting. We could use some of that for the AR, VR thing, which was not really the reason. I just wanted to find out. And they said, no, there's 60 hours, 130 hours of audio, all that's saved. And they said, it's strange that you mention that, because, we've been having internal conversations that maybe we should look at it and there might be something we could do with it. Maybe there's a documentary we could make with the outtakes, but we're not sure. We haven't seen it. And I said, have you got anybody, a filmmaker, involved? No, we haven't got that yet. And then I said, let's forget the VR thing. If you want someone, I'm pleased. Think of me. And so they almost immediately said, yeah. And so I arrived at the meeting to talk about AR, VR. I walked out as a director of Get Back. So right place at the right time.
Indeed. And a Thanksgiving treat for everybody when it drops on Disney+. Thank you so much, Peter Jackson.
Thank you very much.
We look forward to seeing it.
Thanks so much.
Our next guest is also a musical star, but a very different one. Tom Morello is best known as the guitarist of the rock band Rage Against the Machine. But you'll find his latest work in print, because he's writing a series of essays on his music and on social justice for the New York Times, all while preparing to release his new album next month, as he discusses in conversation with Hari Srinivasan now.
Christian, thanks. Tom Morello, thanks for joining us. How did you pull off a collab album in the middle of a pandemic?
It was my only choice. How it began was, I have a studio at my home, but I don't know how to work it. Normally, there's an engineer who is moving the knobs. The only one they allow me to touch is the volume knob, and that rarely. So during the beginning of lockdown, I was staring at a future without making music, and inspiration struck in a very from an unlikely source. I read an interview where Kanye West was bragging about recording the vocals for a couple of his hit albums into the voice memo of his cell phone.
Wow.
And I thought, perhaps I can record my guitar into the voice memo of my cell phone. I did, and it sounded fantastic. So I began sending out these voice memos of guitar riffs and guitar licks to various engineers, producers, and artists around the world, and began creating this kind of rock and roll pen pal community that while I was in complete isolation here, was able to create a lot of music globally.
So you basically tapped into a bunch of frustrated musicians all figuring out like, wait, this is part of who I am. And that has been pent up for these days. And they're like, oh, piece of music, I can do this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this record, the Alice Underground Fire and the Alice Underground, its sister record, the Alice Underground Flood, come out on December 3rd, were as much a life raft and antidepressant as they were sort of creative endeavors. It was a way to, you know, during that really sort of anxiety filled time, to remind myself that I am a guitarist, I'm an artist, I'm a songwriter, and allowing, and also when at that time when every day felt like it was kind of exactly the same, to have the unknown in these collaborations. You send something out, it comes back transformed, and that really felt like a life raft during a pretty troubled time.
When I look at Atlas Underground Flood, I mean, what do Ben Harper and Manchester Orchestra and Breakcode have in common? Yes. Besides you?
Yeah, what they have is they picked up the phone when I called on that particular day. It's just, it's like-minded musicians of different genres coming together to create something that we both love. Now, part of the mission of this, and I use the word literally like as in missionary work, I firmly believe the electric guitar is the greatest instrument ever invented by humankind, from its nuance to its power. But I also believe it's an instrument that has a future and not just a past. And so by integrating my vision of electric guitar into whether it's a song with country artist Chris Stapleton or EDM artist Breakcode or alternative artist Grandson or Palestinian DJ Sama Abdul Hadi, finding a like having my curation and the voice of my guitar be the common thread through these different genres to find a way, a forward facing forward way for rock and roll and for the electric guitar.
So what is it about the guitar? I mean, you've said before that it chose you. What does that mean?
Yes. I had a myriad of interests. I started playing guitar late. I didn't start playing until I was 17 years old. So it was really 2 years in, I was a freshman at Harvard University when I was toiling away, playing some cover song in a basement rehearsal room between the foosball table and laundry machine. When the skies parted, I stumbled upon sort of a moment of sort of improvisational bliss. And it literally felt like a calling. The skies parted, and I knew then that I would be a guitarist. I had to find a way to sort of win my political science major, to pass my courses while at the same time practicing 4 to 8 hours a day. But that was my burden to bear.
You know, there are times when you listen to some of your early work and it is powerful, it's rocking, I mean, it's just super energy filled. And then there's times where I listen to some tracks and you're like, this guy is at some sort of a coffee house doing an open mic night. And you wrote in one of your columns, one of the things that kind of is a distinguishing thing, I just want to pull up this quote. These songs enabled me perhaps for the first time to peek into my own soul. And I found that it might be haunted. On the surface, I was affable, reliable, cheery rocker. When I picked up my acoustic guitar, I tapped into a deep vein of the Jungian shadow, the dark, repressed aspects of my personality that cut much closer to Edgar Allan Poe than Edward Van Halen. So are you trying to juggle these different parts of you?
Yeah, well, I've always been drawn to heavy music. For me, first it was heavy metal, then it was punk rock, then it was hip hop. But it wasn't until my 30s where I tapped into like folk music, and whether it was the early Dylan records or Woody Guthrie or Springsteen's Nebraska and Johnny Cash, and realized that, three acoustic guitar chords and the truth can be just as heavy as anything in the Metallica catalog. And that was where I began sort of finding a different way to express myself, which had always been sort of cranked to 11 through a Marshall stack. And here I'm going to attempt to reinvent the electric guitar. I realized that I had more to say, and I had a lot more to say. And it really began with it was in that same New York Times article where I was at a teen homeless shelter in Hollywood. And it was like a Thanksgiving talent show kind of thing. And I was there, and some young man got up there. He had a lot of problems in his life. His guitar was out of tune. His voice shook, but he played as if every person's soul in the room was at stake. And I was like, hold on. Like, there's like, do I have anything like that to say? And I found that I did.
Hurt the gentlest souls. I robbed my wife and son. I turned my back on troubles, troubles I'd begun.
Let's go back a little bit. You grew up in the Midwest. You had a father who was from Kenya, a mother who is Irish American, and the identity struggles is what intrigues me. Is did you or were you identified as a Black man, an African American young man, and did that change over time?
Yeah, definitely. I literally integrated the town of Libertyville, Illinois in 1965, according to the real estate agent that helped my mom and I find our first apartment. And you know, it was quite a journey. Yeah, I was in the town I grew up in. I was the, you know, for years, I was the only Black person in town. And my mom, who has had an excellent teaching credentials, was looking for a job teaching public high school and couldn't find a job in some of the surrounding communities because we were an interracial family. My dad did not live with us, but I was the interracial part. I was a one-year-old half African kid. And so Libertyville offered us the school offered the opportunity to teach there, provided that we could find a place to live. So the real estate agent went door to door in the apartment complex across the way and explained to the other people living there, this is no normal American Negro child. This is like sort of an African princeling who's going to be living there, which you know, allowed us a toehold until I was old enough to date their daughters. And then that whole situation changed. But it was a, you know, one morning when I was 13, I woke up to find a noose in my family's garage. It wasn't the only noose I saw, you know, growing up. The N-word was a thing that was a constant. People touched my hair, marveled at the color of my gums and palms, and questioned openly if I was their intellectual equal throughout my growing up. It was also a bucolic community with great schools and whatnot, too. But I was Black, super Black. Then, years later, I played in rock bands that were traditionally heard on or heard on radio stations that were traditionally reserved for music made by white artists, and in magazines which normally featured white artists. And, you know, my speech was not stereotypically urban, and there's a wide swath of my audience that to this day is unnerved when I mention that when I self-identify as Black in an interview. They're like, they can't, there's this cognitive dissonance that kicks in, like, someone who makes music like that must look like me, mustn't they? And it's very strange because while my skin color hasn't changed through the years, I have changed color in the eyes of people that I encounter.
You know, you're successful by most measures now, but you come out of Harvard, moved to LA, and I don't have any YouTube proof of this, but I heard you were literally taking the shirt off your back to make ends meet.
There was an exotic dancing stint between Harvard University and between graduating from Harvard and working as the scheduling secretary for a United States Senator. Yes, I did work as a stripper at bachelorette parties because the rent is not going to pay itself, sir.
Is that in the Harvard alumni listing for you? Well, you know, there's a straight shot.
My resume has some rich eddies.
You have been talking about social justice issues for as long as I can remember. I mean, I came into your music when I was in college, and Rage Against the Machine was all the rage. And, you know, at the time, you were singing about a different presidency. You were singing about kind of a war that was raging for kind of a different reason. And I wonder, here in the past 2 years, so many of the lyrics that your band at the time had written found a new resonance. And are you sad that they're still relevant?
First of all credit to Zach De La Rocha, the lyricist of Rage Against the Machine, and Tim and Brad, my brothers in arms. But yeah, I mean, I think it would be naive to assume that, you know, you make a few albums and the, you know, a socialist utopia erupts around you. And the way I look at it is that, you know, each day and each work of kindness or resistance is another link in the chain to try to fight for a more just and humane planet. If there's one thread that runs through 22 albums, it's that the world is not going to change itself. That is up to you, like literally you, whoever's watching or listening or whatever. And while that may sound daunting, there is great historical precedent for on your side. And when the world has changed in progressive, radical, or even revolutionary ways, it has been changed by people with no more power, influence, money, creativity, or intelligence than anyone listening right now. History is not something that happens. History is something that we make, and we are agents of history. And it's just a matter of standing up in your place, whether it's your home, your school, your place of work, your country, to you know, aim for, you know, the world you really want without compromise or apology. That's what I've tried to, you know, what I try to do and I've tried to have my music be about.
You are one of the people who doesn't hesitate from the word class in conversation, in lyrics. And I wonder, in the last year or so, we have seen a lot more union struggles, for example. People, this sort of great resignation, people are also saying maybe it's a great reassessment that people are not willing to work the kinds of jobs for the kinds of remuneration that they have today. And I know one of your recent songs, Hold the Line, was explicitly about sort of union protests. I mean, do you find that things have changed? I mean, is it just a drop in the bucket? Where do you see in the larger arc?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this, what we were calling Striketober, was like the most people on, the most individual unions and people on strike or walkouts to create unions that we've seen in a very, very long time. And I think that like leaning into the 5-letter dirty word class is something that we have to do if we want to see any sort of real change. And I think there is so much power in working in the working class and in unions. I'm a proud member of Musicians Local 47, a proud red card carrying member of the Industrial Workers of the World. The Morellos were coal miners in Illinois. And just the idea that we should have agency in deciding in the place we work what happens there is something that should not be a foreign notion. And the way you make that happen with the simple word solidarity, that's how it's happened before. And I'm hopeful that there is a significant resurgence, not just in union membership, but in militant union action to continue to create the kind of world that serves the people in it, because the people who own and control the world do not deserve to. And clearly their actions are not only endangering environmentally civilization and life on Earth, but in a real paycheck to paycheck way, people who are trying to make better lives for themselves and their family. And the only way to fight back against that is together.
Right now, given the way the two-party system is structured in the United States, how do you think the labor movement or the working class get a voice at the table?
There's a couple ways to look at it. How do you get a seat at the table, or do you overturn the table entirely? Like, everything needs to be on the table now, where we're literally looking at sort of potential environmental, just like this, a reorienting of how people are going to live based on criminal capitalist endeavors. Like, are we going to be okay as a species based on how we weigh profit over so the sustainability of humanity? I think those are things that people have to look at. Now, as I said, like, I am cursed with playing. I'm stuck being a guitar player. I think there are other ways where I might sort of affect change in the world, but I'm just going to keep making songs about it.
So is the New York Times column kind of in that lineage? I mean, is this a sort of, you're trying to be a change agent? What are you trying to do with it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's funny you mentioned, like, these records in the New York Times it's one more way to stay sane during an insane time, like sort of hang on during an inhumane time to hang on to my humanity. I've never sort of set out to be a, you know, New York Times columnist, and I had some great trepidation about it. I have some sort of mixed feelings about the venue, but it has been, those articles have resonated in a way, and I hear from people every day, sort of well outside of the normal circles of people I hear from, who, you know, find something in them that is worthwhile. And again, I will say this, this is something which I've also found in my music, is when I was asked to do a column for the, or when it was brought up to the potential of doing a column for the New York Times, I thought, well, I'm going to be doing, you know, a lot of research on these particular topics about Guatemalan labor unions. And in the end of the day, I decided to write personal politics. And that seems to have resonated in a way that rewarded my laziness.
You know, I got to ask, during the pandemic, I mean, this might be just sort of a dad pride moment, but there was a video with Nandi Bushel, who's an amazing, phenomenal drummer, and she's in her own right, wow, right? And then I'm watching your son play the guitar. And about a minute into this video, I'm like, wow, this kid can shred. And there's literally like you in the background. It's like, that's my son. Like, having this moment. And how did he, what happened? How did he get there?
What the hell happened? Like, I started playing at 17. He started playing at nine, and he's already better than I am. You know, it was a pandemic discovery. You know, the kids, no kids want to do, they don't want to have anything to do with, there's instruments around the house. They don't want to have anything to do with it.
Right.
But during, you know, during the month or two in where the days were stretching out endlessly, he's a fan of classic, my son Roman, he's a fan of like classic rock music a little bit. And so I timidly suggested, you know, since we had a lot of time on our hands, would you like to learn the first three notes of Stairway to Heaven? And he was like, you know, that didn't sound like it would interrupt his video game playing too much. And so, you know, and so he did it. We built on these small successes. And eventually he was coming to me and saying, now, can we learn the solo to that song? And he had an ear and an aptitude for it that I had to work harder for him. It came a little bit more naturally. And so now, like, I'm like the rhythm guitarist in the family, and he can just blow over whatever I throw at him. And it's just so much. He just loses himself. He's, you know, he's 10 years old. He just loses himself in it. And I'm just like, my job now, my rhythm guitar chops are together, because I haven't been allowed to play a guitar. He didn't let me in. I mean,
Tom Morello, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And that's it for now. Thanks and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.